hang on one second. Good morning. We'll call the House Committee on Health and Human Services to order this Monday, April 18th, 2005. We have several very interesting items on our agenda, and we've done this in conjunction with the Developmental Disabilities Community, which is going to be, which is here today, here at the Capitol. They're having their day today, where there's going to be a rally, I think, and legislative visits. So we want to welcome everybody in the audience to the committee. We have a little business to get underway before we take up House Bill 3047. So, colleagues, you have a draft of a legislative concept. It's LC 3567. It's in your packet towards the bottom. This is a draft that came to us from, where is that? The American College of Emergency Physicians. These are the emergency department doctors. I guess they don't call it emergency room anymore. Anyway, we have a draft, and we'd like to introduce this as a committee bill. Your support or opposition doesn't really affect what the bill's going to, the future of the bill in the future, but I'd like a motion, please, to introduce this as a committee bill.
Point of order, Mr. Chair.
State your point.
Are we in the work session at this time?
Thank you, Representative Butler. We'll open a work session on possible introduction of committee measures.
Mr. Chair, I move LC 3567 be considered for introduction as a committee bill.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Representative Butler moves LC 3567 for consideration as a committee bill. Is there any objection? Any discussion? So ordered. Great, thank you. With that, we'll close the work session, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 3047. And for, a public hearing on House Bill 3047. And for those in the audience, make sure if you want to participate that you've signed up on one of the sign-up sheets on this or any bill. Just want to make sure that everybody gets a chance to sign up. So with that, I'll invite the first panel forward, Catherine White, Caleb Arnold, Julie Cuneo. Catherine, are you with them all together? Okay, you'll follow them. Why don't you come up and introduce the bill, please? Actually, we'll just take Catherine for a moment. Thanks. We'll get to you next, okay? Thanks, Judy. Go ahead.
Representative Dalto and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Catherine White, and I'm with the Oregon Coalition on Developmental Disabilities, which is a coalition that includes approximately 26 organizations that represent families, individuals with disabilities, providers, and other advocates. This is a bill that is being brought to you by Self-Advocates as Leaders, which is you'll hear more about, is an organization of individuals with developmental disabilities. And what the bill does is begins a process, a gradual process starting in the 07 legislation to change the wording in both statute, primarily in statute in 07, and begins a process in 05 in rules when it is appropriate to simply use the words that are people first, that refer to the individual or the person first, and their disability secondly. This is reflective of a very strong national effort to show that people with disabilities are more than their disability, that they are people first, and that disability is a natural part of the human condition. So we've handed out a couple little articles that refer to it, and this is a process that will not affect the definition of disability. It will not affect eligibility for programs. All it does is changes the wording to people first. So it is people with a developmental disability, people with or individuals with a mental health disability. It simply puts the person first.
Captain, why is that important?
I think I'm Representative Balto, I would prefer that you hear that from the individuals with disabilities. I can speak as a parent, and as a parent, I want people to recognize my son as a human being, as a part of his community, a part of the state of Oregon. I don't want him represented or thought of as an autistic. I want him thought of as an individual who experiences autism. So I think that one of the things you're seeing is a very strong change in the way we look at disability in this country. And parents of young children are very, very adamant about this. And I think that people with disabilities can speak to this issue. There is one concern that some people prefer the term people with disabilities. Other have used the term individuals with disabilities. It is an issue that for us is not a critical issue. I think the most important thing is that the person is first.
Okay. Questions? Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome back. Catherine, the concern has been expressed to me that, for instance, I have glasses, and so I have a disability in terms of being able to see. I have to wear glasses to be able to read. So, in a sense, I have a disability. So, there's been a concern expressed that this definition of disability will expand so that anybody who has certain requirements in their business regarding people with disabilities would also have to include me under that categorization of disabled.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, this change in language does not affect any kind of definition of disability. So perhaps you would be known as, instead of vision impaired, you might be known as a person who has a vision impairment. It does not affect your ability to access services, your eligibility, or categories of who falls under that category of disability.
Follow up, please. Thank you. So is there a definition somewhere in statutes that limits what a person with a disability is?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, yes, there are several places that define disability for eligibility for specific programs. For example, in the area of statutes that deal with people with developmental disabilities, which I'm most familiar with, there are definitions that explain who is a person with a developmental disability in Oregon. So this bill does not change that. It would simply change it to a person with a developmental disability rather than the developmentally disabled.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Any additional questions or comments? Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Now we'll invite Caleb Arnold, Judy Cuneo, Gal Gardner, and Andy Helvington forward, please. Good morning. Welcome. Caleb, go ahead.
As Bill knows, I'm Caleb Arnold. I am here today to testify on the Bill 3047, known as the Respectful Language Bill. I am involved in an organization with self-advocates as leaders. We are a group of Oregonians with disabilities interested in being being involved in policy and legislative that affects our lives. This bill asks that the office of the Legislative Council to begin using people first language in writing administrative rules and legislation. That means using terms like individuals with disabilities instead of disabled persons or people, or language that doesn't put the person first. This is important that we recognize people first, not their disability. As a person with a disability, I want to be known by my name and my abilities and not labeled as a disabled. I don't want to be seen as a disabled. I want to be seen as Caleb Arnold. I am a person first. Thank you for your time, and I hope that you support HB 3047. If you have any questions, I will be happy to answer them. Sincerely, Caleb Arnold.
Thanks, Caleb. Caleb, I've never seen you nervous before. I've seen you speak in large, large groups, so you always do a great job. Questions or comments? No. Okay.
I do have one other thing that's not written here.
Sure.
Is that when we talk to people in a one-on-one situation, we don't talk to them like, hey, I'm Billy, you know, you would be known as your father's child. Hi, this is Billy Dalto, he's his father's child. You're not known as Billy Dalto, your father's child. In some cases you are, but in most cases you're not. You are Representative Billy Dalto, the chair of Human Health and Human Services. And that's how people talk to you when they talk to you one-on-one. They don't talk to you, oh, well, you must be this person's son or daughter. You know, they talk to you, hey, how you doing, Billy? You know, so
I wish they did.
I know I do, because, you know, me and Billy have a good relationship. But, you know, I mean, that's what most people want, is they want to be known for who they are instead of something else.
Instead of the disability.
Right.
And that's what this bill does.
Right.
Thank you, Gail, very much. Cindy.
Hi. My name is Cindy Ellington, and I'm the Executive Director for Self-Advocates as Leaders. And I'm not going to repeat what he just said about Self-Advocates as Leaders, because I'm here today to tell you about the HB 3047. It's the Respectful Language Bill. It will change the Oregon revised statute by changing disabled person to individual with the disability. Right now where it is, it's from the disability before a person. This bill won't cost any Oregon's, you know, the state of Oregon any money to pass it or to go through to a committee. It just revised some languages that's in the PHS's law. Thank you for listening to me.
Okay. Thank you very much, Cindy. I appreciate it. Judy, how are you?
I'm good.
I'm going to speak through my computer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time. My name is Judy Junio. My name is Judy Junio. My name is Judy Junio.
We did have a telephone.
Well, I do have a...
My name is Judy Junio.
I really do have more to say. I'm going to try.
My name is Judy Garacasio. My name is Judy Barajas Neal, and I am the self-advocacy coordinator of the American Council on Developmental Disabilities. I also have cerebral palsy. I have been involved in the self-advocacy movement of Fintan for over 30 years, and for about the last 10 years I have been doing it full-time. I am here on behalf of the Council to encourage you to support House Bill 3047, which is a respectful language bill. People with disabilities want to be known for who they are and not for their disability. Many of the words that are used now to describe people have a very negative impact. Some words such as retired, crippled, slow learner, and static, just to name a few, can be very dreadful. My name is Judy Pruitt. I'm so bad with the people of I also get cerebral palsy. I have been
Judy, maybe I could read the last part of your text. Would that be okay?
I was going to say, we can read it.
Go right ahead. I think it takes up from we would like to see.
We would like to see the words used. People with disabilities. People with developmental disabilities. And people who use a wheelchair. That is what we mean by people first language. Words can hurt. And the way some people say things are very disrespectful. Thank you for your support.
And thank you very much, Judy. Appreciate you being here. I noticed you changed your hair. It looks nice. Any questions or comments? Colleagues, Representative Boone.
Just a comment. The same day that Judy came to see me last week, that night I went with my landlady to see Rory O'Shea. And I don't know how many of you have seen that movie, but it's about two young men who, one has cerebral palsy and one has, I think it's muscular dystrophy. And they get together, and Michael, the one with cerebral palsy, and he's not very understandable, but like Judy, I got to kind of could start to understand her when I was talking. So during the movie, I could understand him. You just have to take the time. But he had his friend interpret for him, and the movie is happy, sad, it's all over the place, but it's really good. It's at the Salem Cinema, the one by Pringle Park, and I think you should all go see it if you haven't. Thank you for indulging me. It was a great movie.
Thank you, Representative Boone. And thank you all very much. Okay.
Thank you. How's your weekend? Hold me down. Transfer.
Good morning. Welcome.
It's been
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I am Gail Bernice Gardner, and I would like to tell you about the word retarded. I'd like to tell you just a few of the humiliating personal experiences I've had with being called retarded. One time in an airport restroom, this woman said, "She's a retard." She saw me on the plane disagreeing to use a wheelchair. On the 122nd going on the bus, somebody yelled, "You're retarded." They were grown up enough to know better. While I was growing up, some people in my home would say I was acting retarded. It's humiliating. I can speak up for myself, but many people with disabilities can't. And they just have to take this abuse. Words like retarded will probably be around as long as we live. All that retarded means is that you can't go as fast as some other people. But it's been used as a terrible put-down. That makes you feel ashamed and miserable and lonely. You have to make up your mind to accept it or not. I am lucky because people have helped me learn to make a choice. I am learning to think of myself as just having limits like everybody else. But most people with disabilities haven't had that opportunity. HB 3047 will help everybody talk more realistically about disabilities. It will help people in general get a new view of people with disabilities. It will help people with disabilities think better about themselves. It will help us get more power to like ourselves just the way we are. I am not retarded. I am Gail. I could call myself retarded if I couldn't do something, but you can't.
Thank you so much. Wonderful presentation. Questions or comments? Okay, thank you very much. Sid Stuller? Is Sid here? Good morning, welcome.
Good morning. I'm Sid Stuller from King City, Oregon. And I'd like to express my appreciation for what you folks do here at the legislature. I attended a town meeting of our representative senator the other night in Tigard. And it was so rowdy, and people were so angry at each other, that the representative at hand said, "Hey, wait, you sound like the legislature." Which calmed them down a little bit. So I'm appreciating that you have to sacrifice to serve in the legislature. I know that. I'm very sympathetic towards the individuals who have expressed themselves this morning and to their circumstances of life. I have myself a daughter with a disability. Her disability is mental retardation, and she's in the severe range. not speak very well. She cannot be recognized as having that affliction until she opens her mouth. Well, I'm not going to read the stuff that you can read there. I'm just talking to you off the cuff here. We all have to put up with language we don't like. One of the most disturbing words that I've heard uttered by one of our nation's leaders in the last few years is the word new order. Those of us whose life goes back to the mid of the last century remember all too well that we spent 3.5 bloody years subduing the new order. And so the words new order, no matter how their definition has changed, has a rather disturbing ring to them when we hear them today. I recall when I was a teacher in a new high school having some girls stick their head in the door because I was new, and their first words were, "Oh, he's bald." Well, I was accustomed to it by that time because I went bald early, so I said, "Yes, but my mother always told me I'd come out on top." They said, "At least he has a sense of humor." I don't like a lot of terms. I don't like the term senior moment. Don't juniors ever have moments?
All the time.
I don't like the term in the statutes and the administrative rule that says people that instead of people who and whom. I was taught in English long ago that people were who and whom and objects were that. And I asked one of the writers of these rules and statutes about this and said, "Well," she said, "we have to dumb down English these days." That was her reply to me. As Representative Tomei has pointed out that we all have disabilities of one kind or another, and this is one of the disturbing things about this bill. We have people who are perfectly healthy until they reach old age, and then they are afflicted with afflictions like Alzheimer's or senile dementia. And living in a senior citizen town as I do, I'm well acquainted with this because my wife is a lay minister for her church, and we deal with such people quite often. It is disturbing. We have people then who have lifelong disabilities, of those who are present today, and have to contend with the cruelty of the world, which the rest of us, for the most part, don't have to, although we've all had our taste of it. So my concern came from a church meeting I went to a couple of weeks ago, and this church is seeking a new clergy person. And they were talking about the outreach of their church to young families, to teenagers, to sub-teens, children, the elderly, and so on and so forth. And one lady, there were about 20 people in the focus group, raised the question, "What about the disabled?" And the facilitator replied, "Ma'am, we're doing a great job." He said, "You know, we've got buses to go out and pick up people at the nursing homes who want to come to our church on Sundays, and we take them back. And on that, we've got a wheelchair in this church that our members can use and several walkers." People seem to be completely satisfied with that answer. We were dealing with people with disabilities in their mind. The next week, when we came back to that same subject, my wife said about, "What about people who are mentally retarded?" You see, she used the target and objectionable language. But suddenly the facilitator awoke and wrote the words down on the chalkboard because they had an idea of whom it was we are speaking about. Now, I'm sorry that those words, believe me, offend some people. No offense is meant. I have listened carefully to the previous testimony. But I'm, on the other hand, concerned about statutory censorship and an overreaching in political correctness. I just the other day gave a report on the book 1984, which I reread, from which the words doublethink, newspeak, and Orwellian have emerged in our society. And Winston Smith, the protagonist, is talking in the story with a fellow named Syme, a co-worker. And his job is to create new words, new phrases, to do away with the old things. And he explains the purpose of it, to harmonize with the party. And he says to Smith, he says, "Don't you see, Smith, the aim of newspeak is to limit the range of thought." And that's the point I'm making here. We have to have language which, while encouraging people to be more civil, does not limit the range of thought. Thank you.
Can I ask you a couple of questions?
Yes, sir.
Great. And you think that this bill limits the range of thought?
No. I'm concerned about bills of this kind.
You know, I was struck by the beginning of your testimony when you were describing your family, and you referred to a member of your family as your daughter with a disability. And it occurs to me that that's exactly what this bill is trying to accomplish. You didn't say my disabled daughter or describe your daughter based on her condition. You described the member of your family that is your daughter, and then you described her as having a disability. And so I thought you yourself were describing your daughter in the way that we would want, at least I would want, and the proponents of this bill would want the person to be described as the person first, and then, if necessary, to describe the disability, only to give people a perspective of, you know, why that might be important. But it's always the person first, and that's why this bill is important to me. So I wondered if you had thoughts on that.
Well, it's a difficult problem, isn't it? It's not easily solvable. I don't have all the answers, I'm sorry to say. I try to speak respectfully to everyone. And I know that everyone in society doesn't. It's one thing, though, that I don't know that legislation will cure.
Representative Greenlee?
Yes, I'd like to follow on that, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Yeah, but what we're specifically asking is whether you have a problem with this bill, which changes statutory language only in one instance. It changes the statutory use of the term disabled persons to the statutory use of individuals with disability. I mean, does that particular change in statute cause you trouble, or is it the general idea of rewriting language in statute?
It's the range, I think, what Representative Tomei brought up that I find of concern to me, that who will creep under this net of disability in the future, or even worse, that some future legislature before the sunset of this bill will say, you know, we ought to put a penalty clause in here for people who don't conform. Because my concern has been right along that in our society, I am not sure that democratic processes are making headway. I'm not always sure of that.
May I follow, Mr. Chair?
Okay.
Just very, very briefly. The statute doesn't have anything to do with how people respond. It only has to do with how the law refers to people. And this isn't about, there's no penalties for individuals speak. This is simply changing statutory language in that term. So I understand what you're saying in general, and I read Orwell on and off, but I don't see how your objection applies to the way the state refers to somebody as to the way individuals refer to, and that's what the statute's doing.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Chair,
yes, Representative.
I just want to add something. It reminds me, you might remember too, just a few years ago, this body was asked to do the same thing with the word squaw, because the tribal, different tribe tribes in Oregon were offended by that terminology, and it was a slow process. I believe it's still going on, but it made reference to changing the law wherever the word squaw was used, they would change it, and right down to street names and destination resort names or terminology in the state. And it's slowly turning it around, and that was brought to the legislature by members of several of the tribes. And I think it's, correct me if I'm wrong, it's much the same thing that we're doing here in this bill.
Well, I did bring a different point of view to you, and that was my object in coming here today, and I hope it will be considered.
Okay. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would like to thank Sid for coming forward. I guess I'm always anxious when we start to change names in order to try and identify what it is that we're doing, if our actions really don't speak as loud as the attempts we are to change names. And I think specifically of the Communist Chinese government putting itself as the People's Republic of China as opposed to the Republic of China. And the concern that I have is to an attempt to show that they are in favor of people where they have not been in favor of people, have stuck the name people first, and I'm concerned more about our actions than I am the way that we say the things that we are supposed to be for. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Cameron.
Thank you. Sid, thank you for coming forward. You did a great job, and based on our earlier conversation, you didn't show any nervousness at all. And I just want to encourage you in your testimony and just go on the record that I believe that we are all uniquely created for a purpose. And we need to be able to do whatever we can to help recognize peoples as individuals and their uniqueness, and that they are individuals first. And so I will be supporting this, but I do understand your concern as we move forward. It's not about what is written down on a piece of paper. It's about what's in here and how we treat individuals, and that's really what is important when we walk out these doors, and I totally understand your concern there. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Anderson, did you have a comment?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to save this till the end. I think we have more testimony.
But one more person.
Oh.
You can wait till the end, Representative. Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Okay. The last person signed up is Sandra Bishop with the Fair Competition Alliance. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Dalto, members of the committee. Thank you so much for taking time to hear this bill and hear all sides of it this morning. I'm here this morning, for the record, Sandra Bishop, representing the Fair Competition Alliance. This is a business and also a union trade association we're a nonprofit trade association that has set up a research institute about 10 years ago and have been dealing with the issue around public contracts that are mandated by Oregon law to go directly to nonprofit agencies when they employ people with disabilities. And the reason I'm here today is that we were very interested and also in a way alarmed at the bill that was introduced, 3047. On the surface, this bill is a very good concept, but the way it's being put forward, the way it's going into action, is actually going to have quite a few, we believe, unintended consequences. The main thing I wanted to talk with you about today is in relation to what we call the QRF law, or the Products of Disabled Individuals law. This is ORS 279.835 through .865. This is the law that was put forward, brought into existence in 1977, and the express purpose being to give more jobs to people with severe disabilities. And unfortunately, over the years, the definition, the actual workable definition of disabled individual for purposes of this contracting exemption, and the way this law works, any time a public contract is put out for award, whether it's from a state agency or a department of the state, a school district, a local utility, any sort of public contract. That contract is mandated to go to, as I said, a nonprofit organization if they're employing people with disabilities. The original definition of disabled individual in the statute, and you understand this is an exemption to a public contracting law. It's not set up as a social service program per se, but it's designed to have more people with severe disabilities employed. That, unfortunately, is not what's happening today. What's happening today is the definition of disability has gone from severely handicapped to severely disabled to disabled, and now the definition is like this. So the universe or the pool of workers from which the individuals are drawn to work on these set-aside contracts has grown to the extent that you now have a very unfortunate situation in the state of Oregon where disabled individuals who are truly qualified under this law to work on these contracts are working side by side with people who have a very slight disability or in some cases a medical condition, a transitory, what I'm, for lack of a better term, calling a transitory disability. So what's happened is the people with severe disabilities are actually being forced out of their jobs. The Products of Disabled Individuals statute, there are two definitions of importance in it. One is the definition of disability, and I would propose to you today that it is one of the most respectful definitions of disabled individual in or a person with disability in any Oregon statute. It says that the person not only has a disability for purposes of this statute, but the disability is such that they are unable to fully participate in competitive employment. So it fully acknowledges what that person's expertise is. And I'll use a common example. If a person is an accountant, but they're in a wheelchair, they are not, under this law, considered to be disabled, because the disability has nothing to do with their work as an accountant. So it's not putting the disability first. It's actually putting the person first to say, anyone is qualified for these jobs. We will give them an advantage because they have some other kind of disability, but they actually have to be disabled in relation, in direct relation to that job. So the unfortunate thing about a bill such as House Bill 3047 is that it's just simply too broad and too sweeping. So I would seriously request that you look at the form in which this bill is going forward. It seems to be putting something into place that you can't really predict or control. And one of the earlier speakers this morning talked about the fact that the new terminology is going to be used in rules as of 2005. So we've already had the situation of the Department of Administrative Services. The purchasing department has already been changing terminology and rule, which in fact changes the statute, which of course is not legal and of course is challenging. But meanwhile, a lot of contracts are going out. And I'll give you an example of some of the contracts. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. So I gave you the definition of disabled individual in the Products of Disabled Individual statute. But there's one other definition, and that is that has to do with whether or not the person can compete, and then, well, let me get this statute to make sure. And then the other is the actual policy statement in the statute. And this is 279.840. And the policy statement says the purpose of the statute is to further the policy of the state to encourage and assist disabled individuals to achieve maximum personal independence through useful and productive gainful employment by assuring an expanded and constant market for sheltered workshop and activity center products and services. So that's what this law was intended to do. And over the years, the definition of disabled has been broadened to such an extent that now under this
statute, you have a janitorial, a janitorial contract in Portland worth over $10 million. Many of the workers who are working on that contract were hired from a tax-paying, regular business out there doing janitorial. They're union workers, and they're being put in as disabled workers. Doesn't seem to follow. So what's happening is the severely disabled people are just being squeezed out of the pool of workers. So this is just one example of why it's so important to maintain the distinctions of these definitions. The original definition in 1977, the original definition that was put into this statute came from, I believe it's the vocational rehab statute, ORS 344.511. So now we're looking at one of the unintended consequences would be if you decide to change that vocational rehab definition, you will be de facto changing the definition in this statute. When in 77 the legislature really were doing the right thing. This is a good piece of law. It's just not being used properly. So it's these kind of unintended consequences. And I appreciate what Representative Boone was saying about some terminology is so distasteful, you really do want to get it off the books. And she was using the terminology squaw as an example. But I would say that's probably not, it's a good example of very offensive language that needs to go. But in just a quick search of the statute, there are so many different terms that are used in relation to disability that we've got 20 different terms, such as developmentally disabled, severely disabled, disabled veteran, mentally ill, mentally retarded, and goes on and on until there's over 20 definitions if you search the statutes. So I would really caution you. Also, there's a tie to the employment laws of Oregon. There's very specific relationships between the definitions used in all the statutes and employment law. And one of the things that I'm going to introduce into the record today is a chart which shows the rehabilitation facility refund history. Some years the rehabilitation organizations in Oregon have gotten up to $3 or $4 million back in workers' comp refunds. And this program has been phased out, but you'll see the magnitude of what I'm talking about when you make a small change in one statute and how it can have ramifications through the other statutes. I'm also going to introduce into the record a copy of some documents that came from DCBS, the business division of the state. These are old letters written in 1994 from SAFE, 1993 from Garten, a nonprofit, and also from Goodwill. Let's get the proper terminology here. Goodwill Industries of the Columbia Willamette. And these documents will show that up to 10 years ago, there's been a concerted effort on the part of, especially the Oregon Rehab Association, the Oregon Rehabilitation Association, to systematically change the definitions in Oregon statutes in order to allow the rehab facilities to employ people with lesser disabilities. So I would ask you today to please be more, even more respectful than you already are of people with severe disabilities, and don't lose the distinctions in the statute between some of these different disabilities for different purposes. And please, in the 20 years that I've lobbied, I've rarely ever seen a bill that's set up like this one. It would set something in motion that I believe you would have little or no control over. You would be giving permission to start using terminology in rule that's not yet been adopted by statute, so you could probably put some caveats in and say you don't want to do that. But it would make more sense to go through and look and perhaps limit it to certain parts of the statutes that are not tied with employment law, not tied with the products of disabled,
Or another option would be to just put amendments on the bill to say you're not going to change the definitions in certain statutes. But I really appreciate your time today, and I'll introduce all these things into record for you so you can have some more to consider. Thank you, sir.
Representative Greenlick.
Thank you. You and I have had this conversation before, but I'd like to have it again. The bill in front of us, 3047, specifically amends ORS 182109 and ORS 410710. I have in front of me 279835, the products of disabled individuals, and nowhere in the definitions here in this act does it refer back to either of those other two acts. It has its own definition in it that refers to everything in 279835 through 855. And it gives, incidentally, a definition that's interesting. It says disabled individual means an individual who, because of, consistent with the meaning of this bill. Now, I'm not sure how it would be helpful if you would tell me how you believe passing 3047 in any way affects the definition in 279835 when it has its own specific definition in it.
Yes, Chair Delto, Representative Greenlink. I believe that the connection is there because the way this bill is put forth, it is to look at definitions throughout the statutes. I don't know legally about the relating clause being having only two statutory references to it, but in all the testimony and in all the conversation I've heard and had about this bill, the purpose is to look at the definition in all the statutes. If that's not true, then maybe that needs to just be clearer and so the public knows that you're only considering those two statutory.
If I might follow. Just further, even if it did apply to this, it would change that Section 3 of 835 to read an individual with disability means, and it would not change the definition. It would only change the title of the definition. So the definition as it is would stand even if it followed through and changed the term here. It would not change the definition. Is that not correct?
Chair Delto, Representative Greenlink. We are advised that it would indeed change the meaning because there is a difference to those words. And even though you can say technically, empirically, it will not change the underlying definition, our experience over the last 10 years is that public perception is much stronger than legislative direction and takes precedence in rule writing even over the actual statutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, I would say then that's what you have the court system for, to interpret what the legislature puts forward. And answer me this, who is the Fair Competition Alliance? Who are the members of the Fair Competition Alliance?
Chair Delto, members of the committee, the Fair Competition Alliance started in 1998. It's set up as a 501c3. It's a nonprofit, basically set up as a trade association. And it was started in 1998. It had about 10 members there. I currently don't know all the different members. We have some large janitorial firms. I know ABM up in Portland is a member. We have a small recycler here in Salem. We also have people that do processing of mail. We also have some union members. One of the large union members is the OSEA, the Oregon School Employees Association. Because what's happened over the years is not only have private businesses not been able to compete fairly for public contracts, but also the wage earners in the unions have been losing their jobs, and then some of them actually being told to go apply and be declared to be disabled to get their jobs back. It's kind of a misuse of the system here. So it's both business and labor at this point.
But all groups that have lost contracts or opportunities to people with disabilities, is that what this is about?
That's the one issue. The issue that this organization, the Fair Competition Alliance, is set up around. It started as a research institute, and it's set up around trying to find a way to actually get the Department of Administrative Services to actually implement properly the Products of Disabled Individuals Law. We have no problem with that law. It's just that we believe it's being misused when you have these multi-million dollar contracts out there where the law specifically says it's for severely disabled individuals. Thank you.
Yeah, all right. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
That will close the public hearing on House Bill 3047. Representative Anderson?
That's okay. Go ahead.
You'll have an opportunity to comment in a work session. We'll open work session on House Bill 3047. I'd like a motion, please.
Mr. Chair, I would move the passage of 3047. Do pass?
Thank you, Representative Boone. Representative Boone moves House Bill 3047 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very much in favor of the idea of this bill, and I will vote for it. My concern is that we in government have a propensity to establish a name and then change the name and move in many different ways with acronyms and names of different or definitions, and I personally get very tired of some of the names that I've seen in the Department of Human Services, from child welfare to children's services to many different iterations. And I would hope that as we've moved from handicapped to disabled to individuals now with disabilities, I hope we can stay on that for a good long time. It just seems to me that it makes sense, it's a good name, and I hope we can stay there for a good long time.
Thank you. Additional comments? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we remove, and when I look at 3047, it does remove people and persons in exchange for the word individuals. I just fear that that's an attempt to remove humankind from Oregon statutes. And while I'm not sure what an individual may be or may become eventually, I'm anxious for anything that removes humankind from the language of Oregon statute, and particularly I'm concerned about what it may eventually do to the sanctity of human life. So I'm expressing concern about the unintended consequences and potential unintended consequences of those that tamper with the time-tested language of persons and people in the statute.
Representative May.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, I'm going to vote aye on this. I guess I'm a little bit confused about why it's important, like in lines 14 under section 2, to replace persons with individuals with instead of saying persons with disabilities. It's important to change it to individuals with disabilities. But to me, the most important part of the bill would be lines 29 and 30, using the term individual with disabilities instead of using the term disabled persons. So for that reason, I will be voting.
Thank you. Additional comments? Seeing none, clerk will call the roll, please.
Representative Anderson?
Aye.
Representative
Boone?
Aye.
Representative
Cameron?
Aye.
Representative
Greenblatt?
Aye.
Representative
Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Butler?
No.
Chair votes aye. House Bill 3047, having received a constitutional majority, declared passed. The chair will carry this bill. We'll close the work session on House Bill. We'll close. We don't clap in committee. We close the work session on House Bill 3047. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3122. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bill 3122 is creating a 5-member State Board of Professional Art Therapists in the Department of Human Services. It declares and outlines the criteria for the board responsibility. It establishes the licensing requirements for the art therapist practitioner, creates a separate account for the Board of Professional Art Therapists, and Representative Gary Hansen is here, chief sponsor of the bill. This does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
We'll just wait a moment for the room to clear. Thank you.
Chair Dalto and members of the committee, my name is Gary Hansen. I'm state representative from House District 44, and it's my pleasure to introduce House Bill 3122, the art therapy bill. Over 100 years ago, a number of European physicians noticed that spontaneous art patients at mental institutions were doing. They noticed that this seemingly irrepressible instinct to make art out of virtually any modest, humble material provided a method for them to express important feelings and communicate with physicians and staff. That was the birth of professional art therapy. Today in Oregon, a group of art therapists called the Cascade Regional Art Therapy Association have came together to ask the legislature to recognize their profession in the umbrella of health services that we regulate. House Bill 3122 will do that. It will provide a vehicle to protect standards of professionalism in the delivery of service and provide a vehicle for consumer protection. Since I've introduced the bill, the art therapists have asked for an amendment, which I will file, to place art therapy with the current State Board of Licensed Professional Counselors and Clinical Social Workers, rather than to have the art therapists have a separate standalone board. This is a revenue-neutral bill. The members' fees and charges will finance its operation. Art therapy leaders Darcy Hanatina and Dana Fox are also here to explain more about the legislation. They're right behind me.
Come up. We invite them forward. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
And I'm going to excuse myself and go back to another committee.
Okay.
May I serve as another
committee? Sure. Representative
Greenlight. Hi, Representative Hanson. Thank you for being here this morning. Do you know how other similar therapies are treated, or perhaps others like dance therapy and pet therapy and other things that are that have an impact in this area?
No, I don't.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Representative Hanson. All right. I'll let you decide who wants to go first.
Can you just start talking?
Sure. And just introduce yourself before you speak, please.
My name is Darcy Sultanita, and I am the chair of the Government Affairs Committee for Cascade Regional Art Therapy Association, also known as CREATA, which is easier to say. And I am here today because, surprisingly, we have a piece of legislation before us. We have, in the past, met with the Board of Licensed Professional Counselors and Therapists and presented to them what art therapy is about, and that was in June of last year. And then our committee was just in the forming process, and we came up with some ideas of what we'd like to see in legislative form and sent out tentative emails to people. So we were very fortunate to have Representative Hanson draft something so quickly. So we're a little bit ahead of ourselves that way, in that we've been having conversations with the board, but we don't quite have an opinion one way or the other yet. So beyond that, I'd really, again, like to thank Representative Hanson as well as Representative Tomai for signing on as a co-signer, and also just for having us here today. It's a great opportunity. Basically, why we'd like this bill, again, is to protect the public, and it's also for enhancement of the professional level of mental health services available to consumers in the state of Oregon. The thing to know about art therapy is it's a specialized practice. It requires advanced professional training in order to be done correctly. It has to be sensitively implemented in order to be effective. Another thing is that we have a national body, which is called the American Art Therapy Association, which we are registered and sometimes also board certified by. We have a current national exam procedure for board certification in place. As an art therapist, you have to have a master's degree in order to practice and hold a credential with the American Art Therapy Association. And there are 34 programs across the United States that actually have this kind of a program, including such places as Henneman and New York University. In Oregon itself, we have 98 people who are either registered art therapists or board certified art therapists. And there are 30 students in the program at Merrillhurst currently, which are set to graduate. So there's quite a growing level of professionalism in art therapy in Oregon. Mainly with the amendments, we'd like to avoid duplicity. And we'd like to have more strength in numbers as well. I think I've covered almost everything that I have here. So I thank you for hearing me.
Thanks very much. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Darcy, you indicated that you've got a number of board-certified art therapists. Which board certifies art therapists?
It would be the Art Therapy Credentials Board, which is a separate agency, a separate entity from the American Art Therapy Association, and it's a 501c6 as opposed to a 501c3. So that's how they're separate.
So, follow, Mr. Chair. So that's a national board that certifies art therapists?
Yes, it's a national board. It's American... the Art Therapy Credentials Board. It's atcb.org.
And one more follow, Mr. Chair. I'm just anxious. Are those board certified art therapists? Are they recognized in some therapy organization, perhaps psychology or psychiatric boards in the state of Oregon, or do they practice as therapists in the state of Oregon?
Practice as therapists in a variety of settings, including like Legacy Emanuel Hospital and Sacred Heart in Eugene. And Morrison Center, Cascadia, all over the place. But we are only recognized as QMHPs in the state of Oregon, qualified mental health providers, professionals, master's level clinicians in the state of Oregon currently.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Greenlink.
We had a physical therapy bill similar last week, and there was a lot of question about who could do physical therapy. As I read your definition, if this licensing bill came to pass, if a PhD psychologist used what you refer to as art therapy techniques here, they would not be allowed to do that unless they were registered as an art therapist, is that right?
The further amendment actually that Representative Hansen didn't mention is to strike that portion that speaks to practice. It should be a title bill only. Title of art therapist and not the practice.
That'd be much more acceptable. And if I may follow, do you know how music therapy and other kinds of therapy techniques are they titled in the same way, or are they licensed under the clinical board?
Not in this state, as far as I know. I don't know of any dance therapists or music therapists that are actually licensed other than QMHP like us. Across the nation, only in New York, a bill has recently passed that recognizes all the creative art therapists. And I don't know, Dana may know of some. That's the only place that I know of.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Dana, welcome.
Thank you. My name is Dana Fox, and I'm the president of the branch Darcy spoke about, and I'm here to also speak to having a license for art therapists under the Board of Licensed Professional Counselors and Therapists. CREATA is a state chapter of ADA, the American Association of Art Therapists.
And the mission is to advocate that art therapy services be an integral part of healthcare delivery systems. We feel that art therapy is very important, and its importance is that it can reach populations that therapists without art therapy specific training have more difficulty reaching, and that's because art provides a way for those that don't necessarily have the verbal skills to sit and talk about the trauma that they've gone through or the relationships that they're in to put it out there in a different form. So, for instance, a trauma victim could, especially, let's say, a child, could make images of what their trauma is, and that reduces their symptoms of nightmares. It reduces their other post-traumatic stress symptoms, their difficulties in relationships with children. Often it causes difficulties with caregivers and other people. So with the knowledge that art therapists are gain in art therapy schools, they have these additional ways of reaching people. And let's see. So in short, it other professional counselors and other family therapists, such as those that I work with in a community mental health agency, sometimes get stuck with the children. They can't talk about their feelings. And that's why we feel it's so important for our therapists to be recognized by the state with the license, and also to protect the consumers, for those that are practicing art therapy to have this education.
Okay. Thanks very much. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I understand Dennis' testimony correctly, that presently clinical social workers are where you're presently categorized and what you presently work under. Is that correct? As clinical social workers and mental health providers, as a mental health provider?
We're not technically social workers. That's a separate board altogether. We're not responding to anyone. Is that the question?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I need to know how this group of folks are presently organized in Oregon to deliver the services and you'd indicated previously, Darcy, that it was as mental health providers of some sort.
Qualified mental health professionals.
Qualified mental health professionals, and that's one of the Oregon statutes from the late 80s, which groups us with various others that have no particular board to, you know, that they're responsible to. So.
And just one more follow-up, Mr. Chair. I'd like to know what other states do. Does California or Washington, Idaho or other Western states, do they have creative art therapists that have specifically certified art therapists only segregated out that have their own boards?
California currently has a bill pending. They've gone through several. I mean, California, I guess, is a lot different, and it's it takes a long time for something to get through. But they have a bill pending there to license art therapists under LPCs or licensed professional counselors. And there are similar bills in the states of, well, the most similar is to this one's probably in Texas. There's bills in New Mexico, Mississippi, let's see, Kentucky, Massachusetts, Wisconsin, Colorado, and I think that is one, Florida. So.
Mr. Chair, I didn't understand. Are all those states set up that have separate boards that certify art therapists only?
Not separate boards. The only the state that I missed, New York State, is the only state that I know that has a separate board to certify art therapists currently. Each state is individual with their treatment of art therapists, basically. So.
But presently, Mr. Chair, I just need to understand that presently the folks that practice the art therapy are presently working through licensed counseling services, is that right?
Yeah, through agencies, and basically you can collect fee-for-service. Like in the state of Oregon, you could do private practice and collect individual fees. If you're not regulated, there isn't a lot of, you know, I mean, basically you can still do that. We are part of a national board, so we are kind of self-regulating, but there is nothing to regulate us or others that would decide to counsel people, you know, as far as I know, unless they are part of a particular profession such as counseling, marriage and family therapy, or social work, or psychology. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. With that, we will close the public hearing.
Does the board have a position on this at all?
They don't have a board.
Well, but they say the amendments are going to ask them to be a part of the existing board, licensing clinical social workers and others.
They're in the room, but
I assume there are amendments coming. I was just wondering whether the board...
We'll explore that when we get the amendments. Thanks very much.
And they I can attach the amendments if that's something you want to see, too.
We'll wait till we receive it. Thanks very much. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3122. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2702. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 2702 is allowing the Department of Human Services to make grants to enter into contracts with nonprofit organizations that then can operate and provide for specified services to individuals with disability. It appropriates monies for the purposes and it declares an emergency. It has an emergency clause effective July 1, 2005. And
I have a signature.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Senator Gary George.
And again, this bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Good to be with you. For the record, State Senator Gary George representing District 12, side of the valley out here. I'm going to take you back in time, if you would, with me to about the year 2000. And I had sharing general government and had a series of hearings on special education, or the lack thereof. And one of the things that became very clear to our committee as we were here having these hearings is that there was no coordination of services for special needs children. And one of the most significant questions that developed as I was in this hearing is what happens when they leave school? What happens to these young people? And the answer was there was no coordination. Today, as you're well aware, my wife is a county commissioner in a county that I believe is tightly run. In that county, I've asked the question, who coordinates all these services that should be available, you know, to the most vulnerable of our citizens? And the answer is, really, there aren't any. And so when Mr. David Beam brought this idea to me, I thought, what a natural and what an absolute something that we need to move forward on. And, you know, if you think about a special needs crisis center, which is what I believe this bill describes, and as you notice that this is completely permissive on behalf of the director of Health and Human Services, they're the ones that are going to make that decision relative to whether we're going to move on this. But one of the things that we thought about is just check the community right around the building. We have a brand new center just down the street, back towards the center of town, a brand new transit center. And we drove down around and we looked at that building just the other day. And because so many of our disabled folks are transit dependent, and what a natural it would be, to have a center like that there, to be able to coordinate within that facility. Now, it's something that the city and the county is going to have to make a decision on. But I'm saying that many communities have a similar type of structure involved that might be able to provide a coordination for meeting the needs of our special ed special needs population. As you can see, the things that are listed out here basically does address almost every issue that might be confronted by a person with disabilities. OHSU, and I hope you're able to get a copy of this. If not, I'll make it available to the committee. As we look at this community, we see that they are 4 to 10 times more likely to be abused, and we face an unemployment of about 70% amongst this population. And so it is a community with tremendous needs. And as you heard on the earlier bill, the very fact that they would be able to advocate for themselves in many areas, I think, is going to be very important. That's kind of the genesis in this bill, is the idea that many of the providers, many of the coordinators here would be people who are in a special needs situation themselves. We find that this idea of abuse is significant. I'm concerned about what I believe is the abuse of the system. In other words, we may pay for all of these services, but if you have no idea how to connect with them, what value is that? Yeah, the value is zero, because you cannot connect. And you're going to hear testimony in a few minutes from folks that know this firsthand. They know what it's like to have needs that cannot be met, and the desperation, the hopelessness, and the tendency towards suicide as a person contemplates where they are and where they're going to be. So I hope you will strongly consider this bill. I really believe that the fiscal will be minimal. What we're asking for is a demonstration project that will give us an opportunity to find out if this, in fact, will work. We have states such as Florida who actually have some of these operations in place. And I expect to have a large number of volunteers that are going to be participating in this. And if nothing else, to have one central point at which some sort of coordination of services would be available. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you. Questions or comments? Representative Greenlee?
Yes, thank you. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning.
Is there anything in current law that stops DHS from doing this now?
I don't think there is. I really don't. That's one thing we looked at. What I think this bill does is it says you better consider this as an alternative and move forward. Many times it takes an initiative by the legislature to get an agency to move. I'm going to go take you back a few more years again when we first started looking at reforming the agency. And this was fascinating to me, to be in that committee with former Senator Bill Fisher and we'd be reading the reports on what we were going to do to reform the agency, only to find out that the things that we were alleging we were going to do had been promised 10 years before. One of the things that was contained in that is one-stop shop. In other words, all the services available to folks that we're supposedly serving would be available in one location. Or someone would coordinate that through that if you had a special need, we could address it with the services that we currently have in place. So I think they could do it if they wanted to. What this does is encourages them to do so. It is up to their discretion, and we hope that it would move them.
Let me follow up. We heard some testimony about how the Staley decision has created some resource coordinators or something that sounds very much like this. Do you know how this differs from, I forget what those organizations are called, but they're to do something very similar to this. Do you know how this might relate to those?
Well, I think it would fit very well, because if you're starting to move that way and think in terms, as I described just a minute ago, with the new reform of one-stop shop and service delivery, why not allow someone who is willing to step in and say, we'll coordinate that in the community and we'll provide that service? As you noticed, the total oversight of this process would be complete. If you go to the second page of the bill, it talks about a statement of everything that's going to be happening relative to this, the governing board, clearly written policies and procedures, proof and of accuracy of records, and all those sort of things would be present here. And I think what we're talking about is bringing a new, fresh view in there, particularly from the perspective of those who are disabled. It's one thing for you and I to presume that we know what they need. It's another thing to have them actually running a program in which they can say, I put feet under this idea. I know this can help. So that's kind of our thought process on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you can notice, I also have my name on here as a sponsor. I am not the expert. I am very happy to carry this bill to the House, though. And I think both Senator George and David Beams, who have brought this to us, have given us a very, very good idea of what could be done. I agree with you Representative Greenlick that we ought to incorporate this along with the Staley agreement, because there are funds there along with grants to make this possible. I worry a little bit in this milieu of financial distress that this may be the time that it'll move forward financially, but it certainly is time that we get the idea to DHS that we need to do these build centers and provide services.
Absolutely.
Thank you for bringing this forward.
Well, thank you for signing on.
Okay. Thanks very much, Senator.
Thank you very much.
Colleagues, we have a number of people signed on for House Bill 2702, and I want to get to them all, but it's going to erode the time for us to hear one other bill. So what I'd like to do is pause for a moment, hear that other bill. It should take about 5 minutes or so, and then come back so that everybody gets a chance to testify, because some other folks have come down on this other bill. So with that, we will temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill 2702, open a public hearing on House Joint Resolution 25, and invite Brian DeLashment forward and Sheila Baker. Richard Barker.
Barker. Mr. Chair, for the record, Brian DeLashment representing the Community Providers Association of Oregon. It's a association of profit and nonprofit homes for DD and MED clients, and with that, I'll just turn it over to Sheila.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning. Welcome.
And members of the committee. My name is Sheila Barker. I'm the executive director of Spruce Villa. We provide services and supports to over 160 people in Marion, Polk, and Linn counties. And I want to give you a little background information about House Joint Resolution 25. Direct support professionals are the certified medical assistant that's often the last person to give care and comfort to seniors, the home health aide that is the key to continued independent living for seniors, direct care staff that helps people with developmental disabilities to determine what they want out of life and help them to get there, the personal assistant without whom some people with physical disabilities would literally not be able to get out of bed each day, the life skills specialist that day in and day out assists people with mental illnesses to make sense out of their world. There are many names for direct support professionals, but they have more duties than names. In a typical day, a direct support professional will assist with or provide personal hygiene care, help people to be understood by others, assist with or provide basic health support and basic home management, assist people to enjoy preferred recreation and leisure, provide or arrange transportation to appointments, social events, recreation and leisure events, help people plan for special occasions, help people keep in touch with family, friends, as well as to develop new friends, assist people to get to work and to stay employed, assist people to find places or to find their place in their communities. All these tasks so individuals with disabilities and in the aging community can live, work, and otherwise contribute to their communities. Spruce Villa needs 65 direct support professionals to meet the basic day-to-day needs of the 142 individuals that we are contracted to serve. These professionals are mostly women, high school graduates, and have families to support. They come to work for at least 8 hours a day, sometimes more, and they provide services and supports that are essential to the people they serve. Then they go home to their families to give what they have left of their energy. The work they do is mentally, physically, and emotionally demanding. I agree that not everyone can do this work, but not because these professionals have more patience or have a special calling. Not everyone can do this work because it is so demanding. It is easier to work in the fast food industry, retail sales, and a multitude of other entry-level jobs than to be a direct support professional. Right now, there aren't enough direct support professionals to meet the needs of all the individuals that need their expertise. We are all growing older, and one out of three of us is expected to need long-term care services. This morning, the Oregonian read a story about the serious increase in speeding tickets written to drivers traveling at speeds higher than 90 miles per hour. The state police expressed concern about the likely increase in fatal accidents. I'm more concerned about the likely increase of accidents that leave motorists with permanent disabilities. There is a concern about the care offered and the environment provided at Oregon State Hospital. People are moving out of the hospital into group homes. All these increase the need for direct support professionals. Will there be enough people willing to do the work? We need, as a society, to encourage people to value the daily contributions that direct support professionals make to our communities. The first step is to pass House Joint Resolution 25, to make a statement to direct support professionals that their legislature understands their commitment and contribution to making a better life for thousands of Oregonians. Direct support professionals make a difference in Oregon. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments? President Tomei.
Thank you. Thank you so much for testifying today. My question is regarding the second page of the bill, lines 23 down. Especially, what does it mean, community integration and personal security?
Which line are you on, Representative?
I'm sorry, in the very last line, 27. Commitment to community integration and personal security.
One of the issues around having enough direct support professionals is that if there aren't enough people to provide the supports when people live in their own communities, then our option is to not provide the support, which leads to catastrophe for people. It can impact their health, their well-being. But it also could mean that we may need to move back to congregate care, and that would be devastating for those people in a different way.
Follow-up? Can you give me some idea what that would mean, community integration? What would I see if I said I wanted community integration? What would I see happening?
You would see people doing what the brokerages are supporting, people living in their own communities, contributing to those communities, having jobs, doing what you or I do.
Versus living at Fairview.
I can appreciate that. I still am having trouble understanding operationally. How is the community going to support me if I'm in that situation? If I'm in my home, I'm disabled, etc.
Well, Representative Tomei, Chair Dalto, I think what we're really trying to get at there is the whole continuity of care in the local area, so that making sure that these folks are linking those people with DD or MED into the community, into the services that they need in the community, whether it's work services, whether it's recreational services, and so forth. So I think what we're really talking about is making sure that the whole continuum of care that's provided in the communities, in some cases not provided in the communities, these folks have access to that.
Thank you. And if I could follow up. And security, personal security, how would I recognize that if I saw it?
I believe there'd be fewer people accessing a hospital for emergent situations that could have been dealt with sooner.
I can appreciate that. What would I see if I were one of those disabled folks to know that I have personal security?
You would see someone coming in to assist you with making sure that your medications were available and that you took them as your doctor had intended, that you had adequate food in your refrigerator to make sure that it was healthy and not out of date.
Great. Thank you. That's just what I was looking for.
Okay,
Mr. Chair.
Thanks very much. Any other comments or questions?
No. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, the panel. With that, we will close the public hearing on HDR 25 and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2702. And I would like to invite Mr. David Beam forward along with Mr. David Winters. Good morning. Welcome.
Welcome, Mr. Chairman, Dotto, and the committee. My name's David Beam. I used to be in Fairview way back in the 50s. When you closed Fairview down, you didn't understand disability persons where they want to go to in the state of Oregon. They don't have any services. The both governors I ever talked to in the state of Oregon, Barbara Roberts worked on my committee, they worked on this issue. Kitzhopper worked on my committee, worked on this committee. The governor of this state, I got a letter from him to endorse my plan, but the governors don't want to do it. He wants to put it in something else in his services, and I don't think this is a good way to do it. I want to give this the first time in the nation, the first time trial in the nation. Florida got it in that state, doing great. Seattle wants it. Washington State wants it. Idaho wants it. Ted Kennedy State wants it. Boston wants it. Oregon don't want it, I'm going to give it to Dome. And the authority to send a letter to the White House, don't give Oregon nothing till they settle with me. And for disability people, don't trust me, they know where all the services could be better in the state of Oregon for House and Senate.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Bean. Mr. Winters.
Yes, Chairman Telephone Committee. I've been helping David Bean for a number of years, and the things that David Bean talked about, an example on the Staley versus Kitzhaber that the Representative Greenman was talking about. It's true that there's that decision, but the word I hear from people from ARC, for instance, they say of the 40,000 that will qualify on that list, only 10,000 are going to be served. And then there are a number of people that don't even qualify for the Staley decision. Now, according to the information we have through the University of Oregon Health Science University, the exact numbers of the population represent several hundred thousand. The Oregon, I think, like 300,000 to 400,000, depending how the numbers were dealt with. And so the severe disability people, when they have a crisis, for instance, when David Bean was helping the blind lady with the baby, the husband and father left him in downtown Salem, and she was at the bus depot, and when he took her to the local crisis center for women with children, because she was blind, deaf, and mute, I mean, she could hear the baby and see a little bit of light, but because her only sign language was the only thing that she knew, they wouldn't help her. And he took her to the governor, took the woman and the baby to the governor's office and to other agencies. They will take the baby. She can come back in 6 months. Finally, Dean had to take money out of his own limited income because he found out she had relatives out of state, and that temporarily solved her problem. But if there was a blind lady and baby today, is there a place for them to be? No. If you think you are, we'd definitely like to talk to those people, because those programs do not exist. And that's what our Beam Crisis Center, it was being consumer run, controlled, and operated. It's extremely important that all of them have a voice. And now, as the self advocate earlier had the assistant to help them, when people have communication difficulties, for instance, the report from the Oregon Health Science indicates that anywhere from 90% to 99% of special needs people with cognitive disabilities, when they turn 18, 99 to 99% I have traumatic brain injury issues. I deal with it. Anywhere from 90 to 99% have experienced abuse by the time they're 18. And so, but there needs to be a lot more research on what's being done about it, because there are not programs to deal with that. There's domestic violence and abuse. Where can they go? The sheriffs don't want to have to stick them in jail, but there are no other crisis center locations to keep them safe. And so it's a matter of encouraging the state government to have the consumer-operated services, so that there's, because the long-run objective is to make the people able to work at whatever degree they're able to, have a safe place to be to start from, and to work on a plan, and having work with the community, have community volunteers, so that there's a crisis center program that actually works. And so that the long range things that we'll have to ask probably for some other legislative changes, to encourage every family that's willing to take on one special needs person or family and give them a slight property tax deduction, and also for businesses that create long-term jobs, give them some type of tax credit for creating that job, say for up to 5 years. But exactly how it needs to be done, there needs to be some kind of incentive, because there's no way that you're going to get the legislative and the taxpayers to double or triple their taxes to provide safe housing. And so community support and community mentoring and interaction, I believe, is the only way you're going to get that done in a practical way. And and so. Yeah, it's,
Mr. Butler, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I recognize the governor's budget doesn't have these kinds of funds placed aside, and that there are federal funds. But I've heard this described today as a demonstration project. Can you, maybe Dave, maybe you can help with that?
This one will be the first one in the nation will have this in the state of Oregon for the legislature. Every 2 years would be back here, then you know where the money went. All the services in the counties. Now, the mayor of Portland likes the idea. Eugene, Grass Pass likes the idea. Mayors. But I like to see the legislature give this to me a trial, 6 month trial or a year trial. See what happens, how many people we can serve. Then you know what services we got, how many dollars we got. And the lottery office already asked me, will give me the money to do this. But the legislature needs to look at this too, because you got a lot of disability people out there don't have nothing in the state of Oregon. No services, no jobs, or nothing for them. I'm only out in the morning, 2 o'clock in the morning, answering these questions in the morning on the phone. But you realize disability people don't like the police or fire too well, because they don't understand them. So my crisis center would be doing it better in 24 hours around the clock. You know where I'm at. You won't be like a flood or earthquake. You're going to be in emergency. This could be done right now under the governor's budget. I asked him 3 times to meet with me on this issue about a drop-in center. He turned me down. He kicked me out. Now, Mayor of Portland liked the idea. But Salem Mayor in Salem don't like me too well. She don't like my plan. I went to city council twice, asked for this to get this going for disabilities. You turn me down and give it to Spanish people. And that ain't right for turning the disability people down like that living in group homes in the state of Oregon.
Okay. Thanks very much. Mr. Winters, do you have something?
Yeah, just briefly, Chairman Dalton, Representative Butler. The funding issue we're discussing, there's some funding available from the federal that we're, and as to how much is available, I've heard different numbers that are available. They're suggesting that perhaps over, with the right kind of program, as much as $100 million or maybe more could be available from the federal agencies. And it's the other aspect that we failed to mention about the crisis center is that it will be a self-sufficiency aspect, because the employment is important, but also the center would be designed to help itself become self-sufficient while providing training opportunities, which will create alternative work situations, because there's a certain aspect of most jobs that severely disabled people are not able to do. And so there has to be alternative ways of coming to those kind of answers. And so the center would help with working on that and coordinate with other programs, but not trying to duplicate programs, because we'll refer out if there's an available program. Because the need is going to be more than... So we're going to have to find a lot of alternative, lower-cost answers to make this actually work.
Okay. Representative Boone.
And I apologize if this has already been stated in testimony, but is this just for Salem, or is it for the statewide? And part two of the question, if you'll indulge me, do you think 6 months is long enough for a pilot project?
No, I don't. Representative Boone, it's a long-term problem that's going to be long-term solutions, because the consumers are going to help develop the answers as it goes, and so that we want them to also, government, anyone we help, we want them to agree to mentor one other person
in the state.
They mentor more than that, but, and as far as the local for states, it's going to have to start somewhere, and we'll serve anybody that shows up on the door if it has no place to go. It's just realistically, the person that has the need needs the help. We'll find a way to serve anybody, but initially we're looking at 3 different sites, Portland and Salem and another county. And if, as people go through the program, the ones that are actually willing to commit to this on a long-term or a lifetime basis. We want to replicate these centers throughout Oregon and the United States. I know that Beam has had numerous discussions with Senator Kennedy. Senator Kennedy wants him to do it in Massachusetts, not here. Not here,
well, personally.
But we've also had some very friendly contacts from Florida, and we're also did some discussion about whether Texas should be included too. And so anyway, there's a lot of things I can't talk about at the moment, but we're working on it.
Thanks.
Okay. All right, we have to move on to the next speaker, so thanks very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Serena Lorke. Serena Lorke. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Serena Lorke, and for the record, I'm from Scappoose. I have been involved in the developmental disabilities field for now on 15 years. I started out volunteering in middle school, and I've done direct care service, as you heard spoke to in the last bill, and I currently serve as the board president for an organization that serves adults with mental retardation and developmental disabilities. I'm here in support of David's bill, but my concern for it is how we fund it. Our staff haven't had a raise in the last 4 years because budgets have been tight. So if there's new money, I'd like to do it, and there's certainly need for it. 10 years ago when I was working here in Salem and Fairview was closing, group homes were taking individuals from Fairview, and we took one based on what we thought her needs were at the time, and we placed her in a group home that served adults with medically fragile disabilities, and it turns out that her behavioral issues became quite dangerous for the other individuals in the home. And at one point we had to remove her from the home, and myself and another staff member spent 3 days with her in a hotel because there was nowhere else to take her. So during that time the agency was losing money because they were paying me, the other staff person, and the two people that were filling in our shifts at the regular home, in addition to the costs of the motel and whatnot, because there is no place. So there's certainly a need for drop-in centers of all levels. As you heard before, there's not a continuum of care. When people are leaving high school these days, parents don't necessarily know what's going to happen next. So there's a need for centers that just inform people of what services are, all the way up to centers, as Mr. Beams was talking about, where if there's an emergency, someone could be dropped off and it could be ensured that they are well cared for there. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions or comments?
I have a question, sir.
Yes.
So, Mr. Senator, how would you imagine that young woman that you had to deal with would be taken care of?
Well, certainly not in a center that doesn't have trained and qualified staff. In terms of the types of centers that would need to happen, I can't envision one all-encompassing place, because the woman that I was caring for could not easily have been dropped off somewhere. She would have been a danger to other people. But if there were qualified people to take care of behavioral issues, then there was a place. Then that would be a place we could take her to, not a place where the blind woman who was spoken of before was taken care of. Because I would imagine that services could be provided a lot easier for that woman. She needed more structural services. Where does she go from here? Where the person I was serving needed a place until we could find more permanent housing for her.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Laura Jones, is Laura here? Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. I happen to be a friend of David's, and I was saying for years that they should have a drop-in center for the handicapped and disabled. There is a few things that I think needs more help with, especially the school system. School systems, I had a behavioral childhood, and so they kicked me out of third grade. And I know this doesn't come into that, but in a roundabout way, you know, I was diagnosed as mentally retarded, which, that word, I hate. I hate that coming out of anybody's mouth. That's it's not right. They should be people's first. And I live in an adult foster home right now, and I would love to get into my own apartment, but there are no funds to help me get there. And maybe with the drop-in center and maybe with housing's help, we can get something that can be used for a handicap. Most apartments they're not accessible. I lived in one that the apartment building, they had an elevator. It was so slow that it took about 10 minutes just before it to come to your floor. And in a fire, those things, that it wasn't safe anyway. And somebody in a wheelchair, they would have no way to get out.
Okay. Did you have any other comments?
I think what David's doing is great.
Okay. All right. Questions for Ms. Jones? Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to invite Lynn Rutledge. There's some extra letters there. Huh?
I know.
Cool. What time is it? 11? Okay.
I think it's 11.
Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you. Representative Delta, members of the committee, for the record. My name is Lene Rutledge, and I'm with the Department of Human Services. And I'm the Policy and Program Manager for the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services. I'm here to support the intent of the bill, but to testify in opposition to House Bill 2702 on behalf of the Department of Human Services. You've heard a lot of testimony this morning. What I'd just like to share is that, indeed, to some of the comments that folks have been making, the Department of Human Services currently has the ability to enter into contracts to make grants to a variety of nonprofit organizations to provide services to individuals with disabilities. Although some services, county governments have the first right of refusal. I won't read the rest of my testimony. What I wanted to share with you, though, is that the scope of the bill is quite significant, and as we looked at it, unfortunately, as had been mentioned before, the expansion of resources and the capacity are not included in the governor's recommended budget. But we do concur that the services referenced in the bill are important in the support and the self-sufficiency and independence of persons with disabilities, but we do oppose House Bill 2702.
Okay, questions or comments? Representative Anderson.
Are you telling us that, thank you, Mr. Chair, telling us that there aren't areas where some efficiencies could be made in a department of $5 billion and 9,500 employees, that some resources could not be shifted to at least start this out for these folks who have nothing?
Sure, Delta. Representative Anderson, I don't think I'm the right person to respond to that question, but I do respect what you're saying, and I certainly will be glad to take that back to the department, and we could provide you with a response to that.
Thank you.
Additional questions or comments? Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to invite Gina Furman and Gordon Fultz forward. Colleagues, for this panel, there's about two more people signed up, and then and we can have you head out to the floor section at 11. So good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Chair Dalzell, committee members, for the record, my name is Gina Furman. I'm the executive director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. That does sound maybe a little bit misleading because the community mental health programs run by the counties also include addiction services and services to people with developmental disabilities. We're in support of the concept of the bill. We believe that there are not enough funds in the system as it exists now to take care of all the people that need help. However, we are troubled by the first paragraph, Section 2, where grants can go directly around the counties to the state. And while this already exists, counties do have the right of first refusal. And I will keep my testimony short, just that we're concerned about that first paragraph in two, because it does go around the county.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Gordon Foltz with the Association of Oregon Counties. Similarly, the association is concerned about that particular section 2, sub 1. What I've given you in the way of a handout is basically an illustration of the concerns we have about this system and others. You're probably very familiar with the last page of my handout, which depicts all of the services that counties do on behalf of the state. Our elected officials, like you, we're elected, bonded, we're audited. We are placed in the position of being mental health authorities. Each county is a mental health authority. The responsibility of that authority is to review all public expenditures in the mental health area, including AD, DD, and mental health. And it's also to provide, to the extent that funds are available, and that's a big, big piece of it, a continuum of services for those folks. And a lot of the things that are outlined in this bill certainly would be things we'd love to provide if we had the resources to do so. I would look and have you look at the second page of my handout, which is just, and we prepared this only on the mental health and alcohol and drug system at the request of a group of legislators led by our revenue chairs from both the House and the Senate, to look at where we might find some kind of efficiencies in our state or local systems. We identified two, one of which was in the mental health and addictions area, and what's not depicted here is the DD area, only because it's in DHS's reorganization, it is a separate entity outside of this piece of it. So we're just depicting one piece of it, but it shows the current funding system we have in mental health and alcohol and drug. And there's a problem here. I mean, you can see resources going everywhere. What we're trying to get to and what we've suggested to that group, and we will probably suggest in the way of a budget note, is some kind of system that at least has the money and or the responsibility funneled through the mental health authority and then out to whoever it's responsible for. At least some coordination there. Otherwise, you have a system that's very fragmented that does not really provide a full continuum. So that's our major concern. We totally agree with the intent of the bill. It's just a question of resources and the coordination mechanism that's currently in place that we'd like to see continue.
Okay. Questions, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure that Gordon and Gina are approaching in the Ways and Means process that the chair of the Ways and Means that is overseeing the House and Health or the overall Human Services DHS issues, so that these issues that are being brought forward in Mr. Beam's bill here today are being addressed or will be addressed by at least a budget note to begin the streamlining of these processes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, yes, we have indeed asked that there be some direction given to the agency to address this issue of fragmentation that occurs, but we are also asking in all of the subjects we've mentioned for resources necessary to do an adequate job, and quite frankly, we don't have enough to do justice to any one of those services, so we're trying our best we can to deal with it.
Okay. Thanks very much. Next, I'd like to invite forward Bill Dalton. Bill here. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
I was struck by some of the earlier testimony that talked about you just not necessarily always being just the son of your father. And I do want to clarify that I'm not Billy Dalto, though I do get some of your calls.
All right.
I'm glad to be here this morning, and interestingly, and I'll explain that in just a moment, I'm here to speak on behalf of this proposal. I have spent many years working with Gordon Fultz, and as a member of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Centers, I was the director of the Josephine County Mental Health Program for 13 and a half years, so it would be impossible for me not to be able to relate to some of the testimony that you've heard, particularly raising questions and issues about the amount of funds. I think a way that we might want to refer to some of those concerns is, can we afford to further thin the soup? I would take my perspective from exactly the other direction and say, can we afford not to pass up these kind of opportunities? I was fortunate enough to work in Josephine County in the early days of moving toward comprehensive mental health programs as our institutions, including those here in the state of Oregon, were being, and I would like to suggest somewhat successfully, reduced in terms of the number of people that were institutionalized. We've seen that happen with developmental disabilities. We've seen it happen with people with mental and emotional disturbances. And I think the reason is that we have successfully created community programs. But I would like to say that a lot of the community mental health programs and successful other programs that we see did not just sprout forth from existent bureaucracies, if you'll excuse my use of that term. Many of the good services that we've seen expanded to have statewide application, services that now we're all familiar with, actually started out as demonstration programs and pilot programs. And I think one of the exciting things about this bill is it offers us the opportunity to take a look at a program or programs that would fill current gaps that just about anybody in this room, whether they be a consumer or a service provider, could speak somewhat eloquently to. Certainly that example of the woman who showed up who was deaf, largely blind, at least legally blind, mute. We have a state filled with agencies and organizations now that, just because of this very shortfall of funds, tend to pigeonhole people. And whether the intention is there or not, many of these agencies and organizations become quite exclusive. We've even seen that classically within the field of mental health, where the people who have both an addiction, drug, alcohol, and a mental health, mental or emotional problem, have been like volleyballs or shuttlecocks. Well, we can't serve them until their alcohol problem is addressed. Well, we can't serve them until their mental health problem is addressed. And we sit here 20 years after I first came into the state and directed a program, still talking about who should take responsibility for those people with multiple problems. The beauty of what I'm hearing about the program that Mr. Beam has taken leadership on, and the beauty of this, which is really amounts to nothing more than enabling legislation, if you will, is that they're looking at providing a program that would be inclusive. They're looking for the very people that fall between the cracks and at times the canyons of our existing agencies and organizations, both local, regional, and state. The second beauty of what I hear them proposing is they're going to look at being very heavy on the coordination. They're not talking about going ahead and creating another statewide Department of Human Services. The very essence of their program is based on coordination, working with other agencies and organizations, providing the kind of center and service that could identify where people with multiple handicaps and disabilities can go in order to get the appropriate service. Right now, that's very difficult to find in this or most other states. A third beauty of what I hear them suggesting with this bill being the way to enable that to happen is they're talking about a heavy emphasis on leveraging funds. I've lived with systems and services and organizations, currently serve on the board of a couple of private nonprofits, for instance. We all know that funds are terribly, terribly limited. The beauty of what they're suggesting is using a limited amount of funds to create the greatest leverage possible, to use consultants, to use volunteers, to use mentors. My experience is every time you put a dollar into a service that's based on those kind of values and operational efficiencies, you end up multiplying the effect of your dollars. I've also heard them reflect very positively. I've heard them say very specifically, we're not the experts. We're going to turn to the experts so that every year we can account for how our dollars have been utilized, how they've been utilized effectively and efficiently. So it's hard for me after all of the years, 30 plus, that I've been involved in human services, not to be enthusiastic about this bill and not to be enthusiastic about the concept that they're hoping this bill will enable to happen here on a demonstration pilot project level starting in the state of Oregon. Thanks so much. I've seen your attention throughout this morning, and I'm really moved by how much you are responding to the needs of people in our state with disabilities.
Thanks very much. Questions or comments? Okay.
Thank you.
And last, we have Mr. Ed Johnson. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. My name is Ed Johnson, Toledo, Oregon. Definitely can say an expert in chronic pain management and disability. I've been totally ashamed to listen to my agency, DHS, come up here and depose this bill. They're a public employee. We are the public here saying we need this bill. I can speak as an expert, as a pain, chronic pain person. I have C4 going in the spinal cord of my neck, 6-7 going in the spinal cord of my neck. I have 4-6 titanium plated. My head's literally screwed on right. Thank God for that. I have T1 and 2 blown. I have L3-4, 4-5 through 5, and S1 blown. In other words, I have 3 discs in my spinal cord. I'm living and dying a very painful death. I'm a very strong chronic pain patient. I have dealt with workman's comp and DHS. There is no services. I'm supposed to have a medical bed. I do not get the service. I do not get my prescriptions. I'm told by DHS to go steal money to get it by their employees. By my employees telling me to go steal. And they do this for everybody who goes in those offices around the state. They say they don't have the money. Go steal it. Go borrow it. Sell your house. Sell your belongings. But first off, they tell you to go steal it. And that's told by our employees and people out in the line. It's true. It's not no joke. I've dealt with DHS where they say there's no funding. Well, maybe we need to fire 30% of the administrators right now in DHS and we'll have the money. We can fund this program. We don't need overpaid employees. I'm going to turn in a copy. I have my medical record. I've been fighting Liberty Northwest. I've been fighting DHS. Only God knows why I'm still alive. I have 2 spinal fusions. 1997, I sat there in chronic pain, fought with a dislodge in my spinal cord, cutting my spinal cord, slowly paralyzing, killing me. It took me 5 years of fighting the system after with Liberty Northwest, too, where I was basically told to die, which in November of 97, I did put a gun to my head. I did pull the trigger, and only God knows why I'm alive here with powder burns and a hole through my house for a .44 Magnum. 3 to 4 days after that incident, I did get my authorization for surgery, which I did have the surgery the first time at March 3rd of 1998, fighting your workman's comp and your DHS system. So when it comes down to a program like this, we need it. I have all the medical records, all the data from Liberty Northwest and DHS to back up every statement I have said by fighting your system. This system has literally took away my life and liberty and pursuit of happiness. I've lost my family over it. I've lost my wife over it. I've lost even last year when the state of Oregon took the right away for me to feed myself when they closed the bottom fishing on the northern coast. This is what we're doing to our states. This is what we're doing to our grandchildren. So we need to have this bill because we need those services out there for people who really need it. DHS, I'm one of those people that is designed, through the process, designed to fall through the cracks. So this way, these people come up and say, how we need all this money for people like me. They have the money to take care of the right problems. They're not doing it, I believe. I do have a letter I will turn in here dealing with the conversation I had with John Schultz, dealing with the workman's comp. I will turn in his medical file, which I'd like to get a copy of this back, because I'm, you know, not the richest guys that can afford all this stuff. Everything I have paid for the last few months has come out of my own disability and pocket for the state and stuff. But when it comes down to somebody who's lived through the trauma, I physically lived through it. I know what it's like to physically die. I know what it's like to go through emotional death. All right, it's no joke. I mean, all this is medically proven. So when it comes down to talking about it, I get so angry listening to a department when they took away general assistance away. That was the only resource that the general public had when they became disabled or injury on the job or even injury in any type of activity, water skiing or something. General assistance was the only thing that we really had to fall back on to protect ourselves, to pay our water, electricity, so we weren't homeless. When that system was demolished and taken away, there's nothing even for the disabled worker to fall back on. And we all know how disability, when you get disabled, 90% of the time says right off the bat denies your claim. So then all of a sudden you don't have an income to take care of your family. You can't be a man to take care of a family, so you're supposed to lose it. That's what the state's doing right now today by our process. This bill, I do believe, is going to help, especially people like me that has been designed to fall through the cracks. DHS needs to reevaluate itself because they are a public employee agency. They work for the public. They are not a separate corporation. And that's one thing they need to be definitely reminded by the Senate and the House, that they work for the public, not themselves, as they're doing right now today, by creating their own ways and bureaucracy to keep people in a very frustrating position mentally and physically. And I know that. And I've been dealing with the agency quite regularly. So I turn this in. And when it comes down to that, I know what it's like. I have the evidence to prove what I'm saying. So it's up to you to save your grandchildren and your kids, because you can sit in that position, but you could be soon in my position.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Johnson, very much for your comments.
Thank you.
With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2702, and the hearing is adjourned.